Well, thanks, Corey, for joining. Appreciate it. Maybe to kick off, I was kind of curious, just kind of, with your background and stuff. And I was both a, right, a physician and a scientist, right? Sort of your roots. So you've had a good vantage point, on the evolution. You're looking at a lot of IBD sort of treatment approaches of late. Looking at where the field stands today, what kind of excites you the most about this area? Where do you see maybe the next frontier in IBD, but also maybe just in immunology in general.
In IBD in particular, but also across other autoimmune diseases, majority of them, they're quite heterogeneous. So multiple pathways, different kinds of baseline biology that drive disease. And what we've seen, since the advent of advanced treatments, so infliximab, Humira, almost 20, 25 years of access to these treatments, we've seen a plateauing of effect. So we've been able to make these incremental improvements over the years. So when I started at AbbVie, we had Humira. And then we developed Skyrizi and Rinvoq in IBD. And those were, a step up in treatment. The patient populations over the years that enroll in clinical trials get more refractory. So we did see, improvement in standard of care with Rinvoq and Skyrizi. But as you look across all the approved treatments in IBD and even some of the novel mechanisms coming with, TL1As, we see this plateauing of efficacy. And so, everyone refers to this as the efficacy ceiling in IBD. And so, based on our understanding of biology and collection of samples from IBD patients, in doing reverse translation, taking these samples back to Discovery and our precision medicine colleagues, we start to understand different disease drivers. So, why are patients responding? What's the biology in patients who don't respond? And we start to uncover additional pathways, operant pathways that are playing a part in these patients who are not responding to treatment. And I'll take a step back too. Despite patients even initially responding to treatment in IBD, most of them will lose response within a year. And as the treatment algorithm changes in IBD, it has become the treatment targets have become more stringent. So at first, it was okay, let's just make patients feel better, have some resolution of symptoms. Then it became really focused down to endoscopy and looking at the mucosa and looking at the gut. And in ulcerative colitis, even taking histology samples and looking at these really stringent objective measures. So as the treatment guidelines keep up with these more stringent targets, we see even larger gaps. So even with our best approved treatments today, endoscopic remission, total healing, 20% with Skyrizi and Rinvoq and Crohn's disease. So huge unmet need from an efficacy standpoint. So you combine that with the biology. And we are looking at now combining mechanisms to improve that efficacy. And so, in particular, for us, we have our ABBV-466 compound, and that is a combination of Skyrizi, so leveraging a well-established product with an alpha-4 beta-7. So, this is not vedolizumab by any means. This is our own molecule. It's a novel alpha-4 beta-7 that has higher potency. And as we're combining those two together, we saw a doubling of the endoscopic remission rate in Crohn's in a very, very severe population. So, this is really looking at that transformational change. This isn't just incremental efficacy. This is game-changing efficacy, doubling this very stringent treatment target. So I think that's where the field is going, from that standpoint of elevating standard of care, in particular in IBD. And I think this is also probably going to hold true in other diseases. We can see there's been over the past year, I think, just a tremendous increase in the number of either bispecifics, co-formulations. A lot of them are in IBD, but we see them starting to appear in other indications. We have combinations going in rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, and soon to start up in some other indications as well.
It's the field essentially kind of reached the limit of the symptoms-based treatment approaches, so we're trying to move beyond that, right? Is that the challenge
I
there?
think so. In Crohn's and in ulcerative colitis are two different diseases. So in ulcerative colitis, symptoms tend to correlate very, very well with what's going on inside the gut. You have an ulcer, there tends to be bleeding, and that correlates very well. In Crohn's disease, patients have disease anywhere along their GI tract, and they end up over time developing some strictures, and there's fibrosis that occurs. And so they get a lot of what we call functional symptoms. So symptoms that maybe do not resolve with inflammation. This is why in IBD, you really want to use your best treatments up front because you want to inhibit this downstream disease progression and get to something like disease modification in IBD.
Is there something that clinicians right now are underestimating about it as you're trying to move these approaches forward? Is there still something that's being underestimated in targeting IBD?
I think that most clinicians would acknowledge that this is an incredibly complex disease that has multiple disease drivers. So I think there have been numerous case reports of clinicians and case series leveraging combinations of advanced treatments. So now I think the onus now is on us as, industry to help generate randomized trials to really show the benefit and the safety profile for combinations, so we can provide that information to clinicians.
What role do you think translational medicine will play in IBD research?
I think it's huge. Now, I've already touched upon the fact that IBD is very heterogeneous. And as we collect, AbbVie in particular, we collect samples from our patients in clinical trials, and we really do try to understand how to further find biomarkers that would enrich in certain populations so we can ultimately get to putting, the giving patient populations the right treatment that would give them the best chance for success. I think right now immunology is not quite where oncology is from the standpoint of leveraging biomarkers, but that is something that the field has been talking about for over a decade, is really understanding the different types of IBD from a phenotypic and then from an endotype sort of standpoint. So there's definitely molecular drivers that are different, but patients do tend to present phenotypically very different. So ileal Crohn's disease is notoriously incredibly difficult to treat. And so that's like a specific phenotype that, we would look to see if we can enrich and have efficacy in that population that is improving standard of care. Fistulizing disease, perianal disease is a specific phenotype that is very undertreated.
Interesting. Are there biomarkers out there that look promising to kind of, address these areas?
These biomarkers, they sort of pop up in phase twos. They tend to look promising, and then when prospectively evaluated, not panning out. A recent, the Merck TL1A, they presented with their phase two data in ulcerative colitis a signature to select for patients to respond to TL1A. And it did show an improvement at the population level. When you look at clinical remission, the overall clinical remission rate was somewhere around 30, 33% in the entire population. Then in the biomarker positive population, it was about 37 or 38%. So there was a difference, but it wasn't something that's clinically relevant or meaningful or that can actually help clinicians, because at the end of the day, you still have a third, 33% chance or so of your patient responding based on the data. So I think in the field, we're looking for more something that has, 80, 90% predictive rates where you're differentiating. The overall population is somewhere around 30% for clinical remission in ulcerative colitis. And in this specific patient population, based on molecular signatures, you're getting to 80 or 90%. That's what's happening in oncology. But everything there, oncology tends to be more homogeneous.
Is there an infrastructure, particular infrastructure that is needed to kind of make precision medicine? I know it's still looking to the future, but to kind of make it practical in like routine care in this space?
I mean, as you look at oncology, right? Everything is certified, CLIA certified tests. There are diagnostic companies that can help with these. So I don't think that's the hurdle, is making something available to clinicians that they would use. I think it's making it meaningful to clinicians. And so I think it's that we do have a lot of data. We've collected a lot of samples, and We look to tools now, like spatial transcriptomics, even looking at AI and machine learning to help make sense of big data and help to look for unlocking, I guess, of something novel in the biology that would help us understand, how to move forward with this prospectively.
Is the goal like oncology to, produce
Yeah,
individual individual individualized treatment strategies?
I think that would be the ultimate goal for patients with autoimmune disease across the board, IBD and others, just because everyone's genetics are different, everyone's environment is different, and how these things interact together is somewhat different. So not everyone has the same disease drivers. And so being able to tailor treatments for patients is the ultimate goal. It's just been immunology incredibly difficult to generate data that's reproducible.
Are there other insights like you mentioned that you wanted to touch on more broadly across AbbVie and some of the other autoimmune projects you guys are working on?
I think in general, immunology has three gaps in immunology for treatment. One, across the diseases, most patients who have been diagnosed with disease are not getting on advanced treatments. So appropriate treatments is based on guidelines. And so patients are spending years getting diagnosed and then also years getting on appropriate treatment. So when you look at even something like Crohn's disease, which does have a high penetration of advanced treatments, still only about half of moderate to severe patients are on advanced treatment. So I think there is a huge unmet need in unlocking and education across the board for physicians and the field to be able to get patients onto treatments. And sometimes patients are diagnosed, they just don't want to start advanced treatments. So there may be a fear that their disease is so severe that they're going to go on to a biologic or advanced treatment. There is logistical hurdles of getting patients onto treatment. Long-term safety is always something that I think is patients and physicians really think about. So there's hurdles too, once even a patient's diagnosed. And then, we commented on the efficacy in IBD. Across the board, I would say, except for probably psoriasis, across the board in autoimmune disease, it's the same picture, right? Most patients are not hitting treatment targets, and there's a lot of room for improvement. When you look at something like AD, only 20% of patients are getting their itch and their skin under control with today's best treatments. So there's lots of room for improvement there. And I think the third unmet need is what we're not capturing with today's endpoints. So there's comorbidities. So patients with psoriasis and hidradenitis suppurativa, they tend to be obese. And so the comorbidity of obesity driving continued inflammation, the sort of metabolic inflammatory cycle. Also, patients with psoriasis and their progression into psoriatic disease. So joint inflammation is a big unmet need. And then overall, when we look at the endpoints, we can measure fatigue and all of those quality of life measures, but I still think there is a large unmet gap on sort of the holistic approach to the patient. So today's endpoints are good and treatment targets are good, but we're still not capturing everything. So AbbVie, we have our pipeline in immunology has grown tremendously over the past couple of years. We now have in immunology, we have about 30 assets that are either in the clinic or nearing the clinic across multiple indications. And, they're tackling these different unmet needs in for patients with autoimmune disease. In something like psoriasis, where the efficacy is quite good in clearing skin, most patients can get to 90% skin clearance. There still is maybe about half, a little more than half are getting to full skin clearance, but that's really, really an outlier in autoimmune disease. But when you look at that disease, we have a molecule ABBV-547. That's our next gen P19 inhibitor that will provide a more convenient dosing option for patients. So that's early. It's in a 1B right now in psoriasis patients, but that's sort of trying to get patients who are to give them a more convenient option than having to dose frequently or take a pill every day. And then in IBD and others, we talked a lot about improving the efficacy of the current endpoint. So that's where our combinations come into play. I think we have a lot of combinations entering the clinic. And then, as we tackle comorbidities, we're always looking at how to tackle those within our portfolio. So across AbbVie, we have multiple assets that we leverage in combination. And then finally, I think, and what I am very excited about in the immunology pipeline are our B cell depletion assets. So we have a suite of modalities and targets, but I think the most exciting one is from our Capstan acquisition last year. It's an in vivo CD19 mRNA based CAR T. And we have that just entering in patients a couple of months ago. So we're starting to collect data from that standpoint. But this really has potential, these B cell treatment modalities, from what we've seen in the field, to treat up front, deplete B cells, then these the naive B cells repopulate that are not pathogenic. So you essentially push the immune system to reset into a pre-disease state. So symptoms are gone, patients can go back to their quality of life and feeling like they did before they actually had overt symptoms from autoimmune disease. And this is a very durable remission from what we've seen, published thus far, predominantly in the rheum side of things with lupus patients.
You mentioned CAR Ts, and a lot of times you think of oncology with those, but you're seeing some progress there in the autoimmune area too, with the B cell focus.
I think we lost our way a little bit, over the past 20 years with rituximab. It's a treatment that many physicians use for patients with autoimmune disease, but I think what we're learning is it was the wrong target and it wasn't getting into the tissue as well as some of the newer modalities can that are smaller and are depleting in the right tissue. So a CAR T, T cells can get into the tissue and they're more potent at killing. So I think those are probably the lessons learned. And now the field is kind of swinging back and saying, okay, B cells do have a role here, not just with making antibodies, but also they make cytokines, they're antigen presenting cells. So they do have multiple roles in driving the chronic inflammatory cycle, and disrupting them seems to really induce this reset. So I think it's really exciting. And I think the indication potential could be really, really huge here. And I think the safety profile too is what everyone I think is worried about in autoimmune disease, but the B cell load in immunology is much lower than what we see in oncology. So, patients in oncology may be up to tenfold higher, for lack of a better term, tumor burden, right? And then in immunology, most patients have similar numbers of B cells. They're just pathogenic B cells. So when we think about cytokine release syndrome or CRS, that's going to be much higher in oncology patients, and you probably need higher doses of your depletion to be able to really tackle that tumor burden for more prolonged periods of dosing. In immunology, because that B cell burden is lower, and what we're trying to do is actually reset the immune system, we want a really rapid, fast depletion to remove the pathogenic cells and then allow the naive, non-pathogenic cells to repopulate.
Interesting, distinguishing that. And you mentioned long-term safety as being a big focus in this area. When you translate that, I guess there's not too many observational sort of findings, but are you seeing where real-world sort of data sets can be informative in this area?
This is great. So, a lot of the data has come out of Schett's lab in Germany. And that's using the ex vivo autologous approach for CAR T. So different than our Capstan, and I'll explain that in a second. But the data, he has patients now 5, 6 years from their initial treatment, and they are still in drug-free remission. So these patients were quite severe, quite multi-drug refractory patients who are now in durable drug-free remission. And I think the other really nice thing that we're seeing, in particular for lupus, which is a disease that does tend to impact women more predominantly than men, and also women of childbearing age, the data is coming out that these women are able to get pregnant, which is something that they weren't able to do before because of active disease. And also the toxic drugs that were being used to manage their symptoms would, require multiple, like contraception, and you can't get pregnant on them. So I think this is, this treatment and getting patients off of drug is really nice and opening up, I think, a lot of value and quality of life for patients too, besides just like the efficacy measures that we are capturing. So I think that the long-term data has been great. And so the difference between the what has been published predominantly in the field with this autologous CAR T, and then where we want to go with in vivo CAR T is really about the patient experience. So ex vivo CAR T cells are isolated from a patient, the patient that's going to get their T cells back. So you're a patient with lupus, you have your T cells isolated. Then in the lab, the T cells are directed to express the CAR. In the meantime, you are lymphodepleted because you have to make room for those T cells to expand once it's injected back into your body. So lymphodepletion in of itself is not a small feat and does carry significant risk with it. So then those T cells go back in the body and they expand. So in vivo is a much more patient-friendly experience. So this is a lipid nanoparticle, and inside that lipid nanoparticle is mRNA. And that mRNA will creates a protein that goes to the B cell. So this lipid nanoparticle goes into the body. It is programmed to home to T cells. And then once it binds to the T cell, the lipid nanoparticle sort of merges with the cell wall and releases mRNA into the T cell. This mRNA then goes to the surface and codes to go find the B cell. So the T cells are programmed to go find the B cell. But the nice thing is it's mRNA. So it is transient and it goes away. So you don't have to worry about any off-target malignancy risk that you can get from other types of approaches. So the approach that we have with in vivo LNP and mRNA really, really is focusing on the patient experience and the long-term safety. The goal of, of CAR T treatment is to get, patients to durable drug-free remission. That is the ultimate goal. So we call it functional cure. Deep, durable, drug-free remission. And, it's still the data, not a lot of patients, to your point, have been dosed with this type of treatment. And so the long-term efficacy and safety, we need to establish that. And, we will find out how durable these treatments are. And, there's always opportunities to enhance that efficacy in different ways if needed. We're not curing autoimmune disease with this approach. Patients are still susceptible to developing autoimmune disease. So if symptoms do recur, we're thinking about redosing strategies, and what that would look like. But I think the field is rather young, but is very promising as to what this can hold. To me, this is really bringing the next wave. The first wave was sort of these monotherapies tackling disease. The next wave is combinations tackling orthogonal mechanisms. And this third wave is really getting to something that is close to cure as you can get.